This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Donald Trump's ban on immigrants from seven countries, Muslim-majority countries, was met with protests in major U.S. airports and in cities around the world. But that ban is going to be felt specifically around this country and not just in the immigrant enclaves you might think of, but also, for example, in rural hospitals. Rural areas in our country have a real shortage of doctors, and the physicians who take jobs in those hospitals often tend to be immigrants. Ali Fadil is an internist working at two hospitals in northern Georgia. He's originally from Iraq, and we know him from his work as a translator and as a reporter during the Iraq War. Dr. Fadil spoke with The New Yorker's Dorothy Wickenden a few days after the executive order.
I want to go back many years now, because I remember first hearing about you from my colleague, George Packer, during the Iraq War, when you were working with him as a translator and fixer in Iraq. And
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. He sends his regards, by the way. I think the reason I remember is because he said at the time that his life depended on you. I don't remember where it was, but you were in a particularly dicey situation. Do you remember that incident?
That's true. I remember that very well. I mean, I'm smiling right now just remembering all of that. It was in a house of one of the Sunni tribes there in Kirkuk. Basically, when we were talking to them, usually these guys are very, very nice people, and they like guests and they protect guests very well. But for some reason, guys we were interviewing in that house, that particular house in the living room, suddenly they were talking among themselves about how much George Packer worth in terms of dollar money. And that was for me. Yeah, that was for me. That was it. So it's basically they were thinking about ransom and stuff like that. At that time, it was the hype of the kidnapping and all these things, all the bad things started, I decided this is getting dangerous, specifically because they were whispering. They weren't really frankly honest with us. I decided to cut the interview short and get out of there. I remember George was really mad at me.
But this was very dangerous work for you, too. And you had a young family at the time, did you not? At what point did you decide this was getting too dangerous and you had to leave?
Until 2008, when I finally said, okay, that's it. I need to focus more on my family. Even when I came to the United States, I kept going back to Iraq, working on documentaries for HBO and others. But in 2008, I decided, okay, it's time for my family. Iraq at that time was just not doing any better. And things were just getting worse and worse.
Now you're practicing as a doctor again in a small town in Georgia. Tell us a little bit about your practice. You're in a hospital, but you're a primary care doctor there. Are you able to develop relationships with your patients?
Well, we see patients coming through the ER in their worst shapes and all kinds of conditions. I do develop relationship with my patients. I keep calling them back over the phone, even after they leave the hospital, make sure that they're doing all right, especially the ones who are really sick.
And what are your relationships with the nurses, the staff members, other doctors you work with? Are there other immigrant doctors?
Oh, mostly. Actually, the hospital group, which is the internal medicine section of the hospital, is mostly immigrants. I would say about 85%, 90% are immigrants. They're either Indians, Sudanese, Iraqis, Ethiopians, all kind of nationalities. So we're like, I think, 96 physicians. The majority of us are immigrants.
Well, that is really interesting. So, and what are your interactions with your patients like, given that? Or do you talk politics with them? This has been a rather tumultuous time in American politics.
Well, not until recently. So with the primary, the Republican primary, that's when things started getting, well, I would guess, more interesting. And, of course, the majority here are white Republican voters. We talk about Trump. We talk about various issues, including immigration and other issues.
And is there any tension in these conversations? I mean, I don't know how much you get. Obviously, they know that you are an immigrant. We've just had this enormous eruption with accompanying Donald Trump's executive order. How does that play out in your work?
So after the Muslim ban, I have not gone back to the hospital yet. It's my week off. But before then, when we were talking about immigration, and when they say, aren't you happy Trump is president, I usually reply with, no, I'm not. I voted against him. And they would say, why? And I explained to them my concerns that he does not want people like me in this country. And they would say, no, don't listen to what he says. This is usually just a political talking point, and it's not something that he really is going to do. Actually, one of my colleagues, a physician with me, he happened to be American born here. He said that Muslim bans will never happen. Don't listen to this. This is just politics. It was amazing when this happened Saturday. It wasn't so reassuring.
And what about the other immigrant doctors? Presumably, you have had many conversations with them in the past year, trying to figure out how all of this was going to play out.
I've had phone calls from Iraq, even from Sudan. Some of my colleagues whom we trained with together during residency, actually the entire residency, they're all made of immigrants, because usually internal medicine, not many Americans want to go into it. It's not that well paid. It's overworked profession. So usually immigrants coming from mostly from these seven countries, I would say, come into these programs. So, for example, I was talking to my friend Mohammed Al-Tirmizi. He's in Sudan. He was taking off the airplane in Doha on his way coming here to the United States, to Atlanta. He was accepted as a hospitalist in a hospital south of Atlanta, about 100 miles south of Atlanta. And it happened that I worked in that hospital in the past. It's in a very rural area, and it's mostly white voters, mostly Republican voters. These people will be affected because no one wants to work there. It's far away from any big city. And he signed a contract with them to work for 4 years in that area on an H-1B visa, but he was denied entry into the United States. Other colleagues, a friend of mine in Austin, Texas, who works there right now, he was about to leave the country to see his mother. He hasn't seen her for 8 years. Shortly before he leave, this ban came in, and he was really mad about this. He has a green card, and he doesn't know if it's really wise to leave the country, whether he's going to be able to come back in or not, and leave his life here behind. It's just difficult. And lots of other examples.
It also shows the unintended consequences of what the Trump administration is trying to do. Didn't Trump repeatedly say during the campaign that he wanted good immigrants, not bad immigrants, which was the way he put it, meaning immigrants in professions like rural health care?
Well, you know, this is ironic because the residency I come from, Atlanta Medical Center, mostly uninsured people, very poor people coming in their end-stage diseases. This is where I trained with, I would say, 28 other residents. Most of them are immigrants. Usually, this time of the year is when the residency a match system is already, the interviews are already done, and they go through the matching and placing people through the roster for the match. The problem is, I was just talking to my program director this morning, and basically it's they don't know what to do because a lot of these people they interview, they're from Iraq, from Sudan. She literally said about 30% of people from Sudan, 30 from Iraq. It's just there's a lot of people coming from these countries, and they have to go through this whole process. The problem with the H-1B visa, you have to leave the country and get the visa issued in the country of origin. So they have to leave back to Iraq to get the H-1B visa, and that's never going to happen. So meaning these residents who are responsible for so many patients on a daily basis, these programs will be affected. A lot of these jobs will be empty, vacant, and I don't know how they're going to fill these jobs. It's going to be difficult without immigrant people from these countries or even other countries. It'll be very difficult.
And do your patients understand the ramifications of some of this, that they may come to the clinic and not have the doctors they need to take care of the conditions they're suffering from, and that when Obamacare vanishes or is whatever, they are going to be consequences for themselves and their families?
So ironically, even the patients who have Obamacare, when they come to the clinic, they are furious about President Obama. I keep explaining to them that for us as doctors, it's probably better financially for the Obamacare to go away. But for you patients, you're going to be affected more. You're going to come to us with more terminal illness. I've seen it in Atlanta, where I've seen people uninsured come with end-stage cancers, end-stage all kinds of diseases, even though these are somewhat treatable at earlier stages. But they don't have insurance. They can't come to the hospital. They can't come to the primary care physician where all these screenings should be done. So they end up going to the ER. The emergency department becomes overflooded, and of course the emergency department costs way more, probably 300%, 400% more than, actually even more than a primary care visit. Compare $7,000 to $250 in a primary care. The ER cost at least $7,000. So they don't understand the ramification of all of this. And I don't know how they're going to survive without Obamacare, without something alternative to it. It's going to be difficult for them. I feel sorry for them, even though they don't understand it. They don't fathom the idea yet. But I'm pretty sure they're going to feel it pretty soon.
So I want to go back and ask you a little bit more about your own situation and your family. I understand you're leaving Georgia.
So that's correct. Back in late 2015, early 2016, when Trump was in the picture and when the Republican primary was at its ugliest moments, things started to change here at home in Suwannee, in my area. My kids started hearing things about Muslims, about ISIS and stuff like that. I have two kids, Sarah, she's 13, and Adam, 11, and both in middle school. And so a lot of ugly things happened to them at school. So Sarah's nickname became Sarah ISIS. And Adam, they were asking him about his relation to ISIS and if he's a relative of ISIS and so on and so on. So they come back home. They're furious from the bus. Sarah would be ranting as soon as she get at home. She says, this girl behind me in the bus, she keeps playing the same song every day behind my ear. And when I ask her what the song is about, she says the song is about how Arabs mate with camels and stuff like that. Very vulgar songs.
And they hadn't experienced anything like this before?
Not really, no. Even here in Suwannee, we didn't feel anything like that. Back in Atlanta, we didn't feel anything like that when we used to live there a couple of years, 3 years ago. So we never felt this before the primaries, before the election. But when Trump came in power, I mean, when he won the primaries, as soon as this new year, new school year started, things really escalated. This became a regular thing. I complained to school, the kids went to their counselor, and nothing really happened. My daughter started wearing what would Jesus do bracelets. Just so that she says, if I wear this, nobody's going to ask me this way. It'll be easier for me. The day will be easier. So that's what they're doing right now.
Has it changed? I'm interested in them as American children. At least that's how they presumably they saw themselves until the past six to 9 months. Talk a little bit about that and whether this has changed their feelings about their country.
Well, I started hearing a lot of bad words here at home, like rednecks and stuff like that. So. To be honest with you, myself, I didn't do a good job initially with the hype of the election. I myself became so polarized. So I agreed with them in these terms. But once the election happened and the morning after, I felt that we made a big mistake.
Yes.
So we decided at home not to ever use the terms rednecks, white supremacist or racist and all these things, just to say that these people are ignorant. That's basically why they're saying this and they need to understand better. Meanwhile, when Trump won the elections, the primaries, I immediately said to my wife, Zina, we have to search for a job in California. This guy is going to win. There's a big possibility he's going to win.
You thought he was going to win?
Oh, yeah.
Against
the odds of my friends, against the odds of my wife was saying, you're crazy. This is never going to happen.
Why did you think that?
Because he was just using a language very similar to the language of our politicians back home. He is radical in terms of not the religion, but in terms of politics. In Iraq, the politicians who usually win, they use radical religious terms. So extremists, the extremists of the extremist Shiites, they are the ones who win the election. The extremists of the extremist Sunnis are the ones who win the election.
But did you feel that it was comparable in the United States? We were obviously mainstream media got this completely wrong. But, you know, pluralist America, people thought that this was just beyond the pale. And then when it came down to it, people simply would not stand for this.
Well, I did not think that he's going to win the election before the primaries. When he won the primaries, it was very obvious. My suspicions were in place. I'll tell you why. Because when you work in a hospital, you usually see people at their worst conditions. And usually they speak their mind, their hearts. And when I see it here in my hospital, even in my wife, she works in the same hospital, in different campus, but the same hospital. We both saw it. Our patients come in and it's Trump. And I knew that in this area, in the suburbs, Trump is winning. And whether he lost the election or not, at the end, this area is just not a place for me to live.
So where are you going?
So right now we're going to California. I'm incurring a huge financial loss by moving to California. We thought about the options between California and the Northeast Coast, because these are the places that we know we are going to melt with the rest of the population easily. Nobody's going to differentiate.
So are the kids on board with the move?
Believe it or not, they're really excited about it. They're tired about all of this. For them, seeing Trump on the TV and connecting this with what they're seeing in school is just too much. It's a daily, psychologically tormenting issue for them. Especially my daughter, Sarah, she's very active politically.
What does she want to do? Does she know yet when she grows up?
She does. She want to be super rich and go to Hawaii and live in Hawaii.
Good for her. Well, I wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Dr. Ali Fadil talking with Dorothy Wickenden. Dorothy is executive editor of The New Yorker, and she hosts our podcast, Politics and More, with conversations about what's happening in Washington and in foreign affairs.